our acquisition costs were massive because we were way too reliant on Google and Facebook advertising. And it was one of those kind of into Jesus moments where it was like, this, if we keep going like this, like, we're going to run out of road, going to have to make a big and brave bet.
How much of that was a privilege that set you up to make that decision easier for you?
It's like, it was a horrible bet to make. It felt terrible. Triple the size of our business in a year.
Wow.
With that campaign, while halving our cost to acquire. Just hit by the storm of COVID. A bit like the sort of these, you know, these hand grenades that roll into your life, whether personal or professional. That just changed everything.
If Chameleon is as successful as it can be, then what would the world look like in 10 years' time?
That's a great question. People feel really, really awful about money in general and carry around a huge amount of anxiety. I think if you save £1 a day from the age of 22, you would have 50% of what you need for a comfortable retirement at the point of retirement. It's pretty bonkers.
Welcome to another weekly episode of Strategy and Tragedy, the show that spotlights the highs and lows of starting, scaling, and even exiting your own business. If this is your first time tuning in, then as a quick introduction to your host, my name is Stephanie Melodia, and for about 6 years, I ran an award-winning marketing agency for startups and scale-ups. Over that time, we worked with over 100 founders and their scaling teams, which put me in a very privileged position of hearing everyone's stories, including their trials and tribulations. Little did they know, they were all experiencing the same challenges. As I was the one at the epicenter of all the conversations, I was privy to certain themes and patterns, which is one of the main reasons I started the show. Strategy and Tragedy, as the name suggests, is all about sharing both the highs and lows of business, because entrepreneurship, even for the most level-headed among us, is a roller coaster. And whilst you're an unstoppable trailblazer, you don't have to make the same mistakes that others have done before you. Entrepreneurship has also been overly glamorized in recent years. Yes, it can be extremely rewarding and you get to make an impact on the world whilst hopefully making money and growing a team. But that's not to say it's without its challenges. And boy, are the challenges tough. But you already know that. It's with this backdrop that I started the show to share with you the most important lessons learned and practical, actionable tips from entrepreneurs, investors, and subject matter experts telling it how it is to help you in your business journey too. To hear more about the philosophy behind Strategy and Tragedy, I recommend you bookmark episode 0, which says Start Here, to listen to straight after this episode. It's only 6 minutes long, and at double speed, that means it's only 3 minutes of context. With all that being said, I'm so excited to interview my next guest, Daniel Hegarty, the founder and former CEO of Habito, now founder and CEO of Chameleon. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you prefer Dan, right, instead of Daniel?
I don't mind. Not at all. Not fussy. I'm just glad you're talking to me.
So I would say that you're more famous for Habito, leading prop tech. I think it's fair to say that revolutionized the whole mortgage game. So let's start there. If we rewind the clock and take us back to those early days of how you got started, how you transitioned from Wonga and the other roles that you had.
Of course. It seems like a long time ago now, which is worrying. It must be getting old. So now Habito was in many ways like a classic kind of tricky personal experience that turned into a business idea. It was about 10 years ago now, I was buying my first home, which always, I guess, particularly in London, feels like a bit like a miracle if you ever get to do that. And I remember, you know, I didn't really understand anything about it, which is embarrassing to admit now. I didn't understand about stamp duty and mortgage brokers. And I had a guy who was helping me, and he did such a sort of hilariously bad job in the end that he submitted my application to the mortgage lender with me, my partner, and my partner again. And so it was declined on the basis that I was a bigamist or a polygamist or something. But that took 10 days, and then he resubmitted it, but this time he removed me and just had my partner twice, and another 10 days passed. And the people who were selling me the house, who I think were a bit suspicious of me generally, I don't know why, pulled out. And so we had this moment of real reckoning where, you know, this dream that I'd been working towards, you know, we're all working towards to some degree, suddenly it was falling apart because somewhere someone had to fax a paper application form to someone somewhere in the world. So I just had that very kind of, I guess, that very basic entrepreneurial thought of like, well, this seems broken, that's interesting, and it seems important to a lot of people. Maybe there's a chance to do something about this. And so, yeah, in total ignorance, I steamed in with this idea that we could digitize it and make it better and more transparent, and spent the best part of 10 years trying to make that come to fruition.
I mean, you call it ignorance. I do think that ignorance is bliss sometimes, but I would call that more kind of blind optimism going into it.
Precisely. I think you definitely need a healthy serving of that in this job.
But I wouldn't be, you know, the whole understanding stamp duty and going through that house buying process, unless you go through it, and it does, stuff doesn't get taught in schools.
Why would you know?
Why would you know? You go through that process and you see how broken it is. The Hello Habito comes to mind, the famous campaign, which I love, by Uncommon, which I fangirl over so much. So we're definitely going to talk about them because I just love them to pieces. But before we get on to that, you succeeded in raising, I think, was it over 70 million during the 8 years of Habito?
Something like that.
From top VCs such as Atomico. So we definitely need to touch on that as well. I'm sure many founders who are listening to this are really struggling in this climate in terms of fundraising. What was that process like for you? What were your top takeaways during your fundraise?
To be frank, it was an easier time to raise, for sure. Like, there was a general enthusiasm. And I think, and I don't want to be negative, but VCs often can be a little, slightly lazy pattern matchers. And I think there was a bit of a, Funding Circle are doing this for peer-to-peer, TransferWise are doing this for foreign, international transfers. It's the mortgage one. Great. So I think there was a little bit the story was told by themselves as to why they would like to invest. But I think the core of any fundraising is storytelling. And it's not always, the natural gift of a founder who's, depending on what background you come from, kind of wants to fix things and optimize things and make a better machine. Sort of making up a consumable narrative about that machine is not always the easiest thing. But I think just there's something about the house purchase process that is just so fundamentally human and such a common and relatable narrative. Everyone wants shelter. Everyone is like projecting this idea of a family in the back garden and that whole thing. That it made it a very easy story to explain.
Okay.
And I think almost, and we can talk about Hello Habito as well, but anyone who's bought a house has had a bad house buying experience. There's 100% hit rate.
Even just with renting, actually, even without the buying, I've had so many nightmares.
It's a mess. It's a complete mess. And it's so fundamental to the economy and to the human experience that it's an easy place to kind of conjure emotions and like paint a better future.
Yeah.
I think that was a big part of it. Mm. And then also you just got to prove it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, particularly nowadays, that you just need to have the numbers.
So did you have that early traction to be able to bolster your story, your pitch to the investors?
I think we did. I think we, I remember actually my old boss saying to me, you'll know in a week if it's a good idea or not, the week after launch, because either they'll show up or they won't. Hmm. And I remember really hating him for giving me that advice, because I spent the whole 6 months leading up to the launch being like, no one's going to come to my party. And it'll be over on day two. But they didn't. As soon as we put online mortgage broker on Google, the clicks started coming. I think, as you kind of would expect, right, it was almost, even at that point 10 years ago, peculiar that you couldn't do this online. So there was the early traction was good.
So were there any other competitors around this time?
There was. There was another competitor that launched a couple of months before us called Trussell, I sort of always said that I never thought about, because obviously we'd never think about the competitors, we're in our own lane, but did use quite a lot to rally the troop with, we were going to grind them into dust and ruin their lives, which I found quite helpful. Slightly depressingly about the human condition, but it did really well.
So I appreciate this is going back a while ago, so memory is a little bit foggy perhaps, but what was your competitive advantage then against the competition? Because I feel like the fundraise story sounds, quite easy breezy, which I've never heard before. So I'm still sticking with this a minute to kind of dive in a little bit to kind of extrapolate some of the key.
So it's slightly unhelpful. It's not great advice. And I think I had a little bit of an unfair advantage in that I had come from Wonga, which in many ways was sort of the first fintech in Europe, arguably, and certainly the first sort of consumer fintech. So I think there was a general assumption that if you'd been there, you knew how to make stuff. And so the idea that there weren't many people who were sort of on their second run through building a consumer fintech business. So I think I had a bit of unfair help in terms of, not necessarily earned credibility, but credibility nonetheless. But this, actually speaking again to the Hello Habito work we did with Uncommon, I think in the end, the biggest difference between us and Trussell, who, essentially, similar number of engineers, similar level of funding, was storytelling. It was that we found a way to connect to both to the investors and to the consumers, and make it not just a solution to an optimization problem, but like a sort of a thing that could make a difference in people's lives and in the world. And I know that sounds grandiose, but that is kind of the wonderful thing about finances. It does, it like touches absolutely every aspect of people's lives, and if you get it right, it can make a really positive difference, and if you get it wrong, it can be
really bad. Really connecting on that human level. There's such a clear, obvious, deep pain point that you're solving for people as well, so that does make sense. I did hear you also talk about your struggles to find a co-founder, which I thought was really interesting, and I think particularly with the investment journey as well, I know that many VCs do express a preference for co-founder teams. It kind of de-risks things a little bit.
Yeah.
Was that ever a challenge for you? Did that come up?
It never came up. If I'm being completely frank about it, I never looked for a co-founder. So I sort of joke that no one wanted to do it, but I certainly never tried to find one. The truth is, I think, like many founders, like at some level, I'm like not the best guy in the world. And what I've found is that I'm a much better dude when I'm in charge. And there's a lot, I get a lot less sharp-elbowed and a lot less frustrated when I kind of have complete decision-making power.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that just worked a lot better for me psychologically. And even when I came to do it again, I wasn't like, Jesus, I wish I'd had a buddy. And also the other thing is you end up, like if you build a great team with you, like they're all co-founders in reality. It's like a completely like artificial delineation. And I was totally reliant on the people that I worked with and built Habitat with, and I'm again in communion. So I never, that sort of loneliness of the solo founder, I never experienced that.
Yeah, I definitely relate to that. I have heard stories of solo founders where they do wish they had, you know, someone else in the trenches with them, even just to be able to pass the baton to go on holidays, for example. Yeah. But we had another really interesting guest on the show who shared her nightmare story of like the absolute worst thing that, and she went through a lot. The worst thing that happened to her was the co-founder relationship breaking down. And it was obviously, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but it was the realization that that desire to find a co-founder had stemmed from a place of insecurity. And she said that herself, right? She was like, I just felt, you know, I just kind of lacked that self-confidence, but, you know, I never really needed that to begin with. So it does sound like it's more of kind of a VC play, maybe now as well, where it's tougher, but it's great to hear you've got, you know, that self-awareness, the team around you that you foster as well, you know, they're all in the trenches there with you anyway, so.
I think that's the other, and the thing you say about insecurity is spot on, and I think that I think the danger, and I do a bit of investment, and I see this a lot in founder pairings that go awry, is that the founder thinks that they have to like carry all the weight and sort of be this umbrella that sort of blocks out reality and just keeps everyone focused on the problem. And I definitely did that at times. It's not sustainable. And more than that, as soon as I sort of let, you know, the darkness into the business, like nobody left, nobody panicked. Like you realize that you're infantilizing the people you work with and actually not giving them the chance to be the best version of themselves. So yeah, as soon as I kind of learned that lesson, my life got immeasurably easier.
I love that. I love that so much. A great little soundbite there. I definitely want to highlight that and use that in social so everyone hears that little bit. So Uncommon we mentioned. So for anyone who's unaware, Uncommon are categorically, objectively, the best creative studio in the world. I haven't had the pleasure of being a client of theirs, though, and sitting in your shoes on that side of the fence. So I'm just super curious. I come from that industry, come from the world of creative and advertising marketing. I have obviously put them on a pedestal. I've got a lot of questions. Quick questions I want to ask you with this. So one is, how were you able to, what was the decision-making process to work with an agency like that when you were at that startup scale-up sort of stage? Because I feel like, you know, their client roster includes the likes of British Airways and ITV and all these other like huge top brands. So was there anything that was maybe off-putting in terms of price tag or?
No, we were their founding client.
Ah.
So they were, I think, 7 or 8 people in a room in Clerkenwell.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think at the same time as ITV, I think we were similar. Ah. But they say it, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but they definitely say we were their founding client.
Okay.
So no, they were brand new. And I guess for us, the decision-making process was more, should we be working with a creative agency? Do we have the budgets? Are we even ready for this? But the truth is it was, things weren't going very well. We were acquiring customers. We had early traction. But our acquisition costs for customers were massive because we were way too reliant on Google and Facebook advertising. And it was one of those kind of come to Jesus moments where it was like, this, if we keep going like this, like we're going to run out of road. and we're going to have to make a big and brave bet on something. And to my sort of previous point, I really felt like it was, yeah, like just online mortgage broker was not a good enough story to be telling, given the potential of what we were doing. And so we spoke to maybe three or four different agencies, and they stuck out a mile. Mostly because I got into a big row with Nils, one of the founders, in the meeting.
Oh, hilarious.
Because I was being my usual, like, well, I don't know about this. It all sounds like silly showing off and da-da-da-da. And he was just, and he very, very frankly was like, buddy, what would you know? And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh my God, I can perfectly picture Nils exactly. doing that as well.
And
that's
essentially,
hilarious.
We've been having that conversation for now about a decade. Of me being
so
like, this
funny.
Is stupid, this is never going to work. And then being like, why don't we see?
Oh my God, this is why he is such a true rock star. He
he's
just
a good dude.
Lives and breathes it. Oh my
he's,
God,
he's
I love
he's a very,
that.
Very good dude. And he's and I should say they've been partnered with us on Communion. They all of our brand design.
Yeah,
they've
I
been
saw,
with us since day one.
I saw.
We hang out. We mostly work out of their office.
Oh my God, how amazing! Well, we're definitely going to talk about Communion as well, of course. So we need to make time for that later on. But I have to honestly, like, huge kudos for recognizing that you needed to take that bigger brand bet in order to, like, build out that narrative, that storytelling, build a brand, lower acquisition costs. It just feels like it's been a big drum of mine that I've been beating constantly for the past few years. And it just feels like this, I guess from the more the agency side of the fence, it feels like this uphill battle, the struggle, the how much we need to prove it when there are numbers there. There is research, there are many case studies, there are hard facts and figures, but this over-reliance on performance marketing, that short-termist thinking has just become so pervasive in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. I extremely rarely have met somebody probably zero actually in the past couple of years. I haven't met anyone who's either been willing to take those big brand bets or understanding the importance of it. So I guess, like, how much of the easy breezy sort of picture that you paint of that fundraising journey, how much of that, you know, was a privilege that set you up to make that decision easier for you to say, we need to take this big brand bet?
That's a good question. Yeah, we did raise a very, like, meaningful Series B very soon after, like within 10 months of our Series A. So we did have a little more cash probably than most in our position. But the truth is like it was a horrible bet to make. It felt terrible because because the minimum bet is, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds, right? There's no, let's stick another £5,000 in the TikTok account. And I remember very, and actually we tried once before. We tried once before at a much lower scale. We tried some TV, and I forget the bet, but it was a lot. It was like 50 or 100,000 pound bet. And I remember I was on holiday and I was like watching the graphs like the day that the ad aired, and the graphs just stayed completely flat. Like it didn't make a single iota of difference. And I remember thinking, oh God, like, is that, you know, because those bets can all be mortal for the company.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think we, that experience, I think we were quite clear that we'd gone the very cheap route on the creative and hadn't told the right story. But with the Uncommon stuff, it felt much more, I don't know, I just had this, even, and it was quite odd work, you know, it was like very sort of iconoclastic or countercultural, however you want to think about it. It was basically people being like disemboweled by mortgages on TV, which is not normal. But I had this faith in it because I felt like for all of its strangeness, like it spoke to a fundamental human truth that most people literally did feel like they'd been disemboweled after getting a mortgage.
Yeah.
And it did it in a way that was charming. But one interesting thing about it was we made a series of those adverts over years, and they did start performing worse over time. And the really funny thing was because we didn't realize it, but every ad we made was more extreme than the last. And so the first one was kind of this charming, you know, guy getting his spine ripped out, but in a very comic way. And by the end, it was people exploding in pus because, like, interest rate hornets had got them. Those did not work. And it was a really interesting example of being like, we found a groove here, and then sort of boiling the frog of our own sensibility.
Right. No, yeah, we went a bit too far with that one.
The last one, I forget, was a few hundred complaints and no sales. It was that wasn't the one.
That's so interesting. Do you have any background in marketing, advertising, or do you know people close to you to have? Because I'm fascinated by this level of appreciation that you have for it, especially with it not having worked well before. Because as in my experience, what I've been exposed to is even if someone has had the courage to make those big brand bets. You don't have that, you know, immediate ROI. You can't just put a chunk here, chunk there, and then immediately see the graph go up. For that to have, I guess, failed the first time around, 9 out of 10 people would have turned around and said, oh, okay, well, that was a waste of money. That was a big mistake. So to not only go for it in the first place, but to go for it again, that's just where I'm curious.
It's a really good question. I think ultimately I'm a frustrated creative. And it's funny, when I have my investor hat on, this is by far the most common conversation. It's founders who tend to not be from a marketing background, in my experience, just being like, well, you know, this is the voodoo, this can't be measured or sort of predicted, and so wanting help with it. And the truth is it can't perfectly, and not every great creative turns into great sales, and sometimes the products, you know, there's a thousand reasons these things cannot work. But I do think, yeah, for better or for worse, I just wanted to make cool and interesting stuff. I got a taste of it, particularly, you know, with Niels as a sort of thought partner on it, it was exciting and I wanted to do it. And then the early results of that campaign were incredibly positive.
Amazing.
So it became very easy just to... I think we tripled the size of our business in a year.
Wow.
With that campaign, while halving our cost to acquire. It was completely binary. Like, there was the business before and the business after.
Wow. Before Uncommon and after. That's amazing.
Yeah, don't tell. Niels is already feeling good enough about himself.
Adding to like the testimonials, marketing materials for those guys. I was going to ask you about how the campaign performed as well. So thanks for coming on to that. It's really, really interesting. Quick one. I need to tell you a bit about Patreon. If you haven't heard of it before, Patreon is the creator platform that enables people like you to support podcasters like me. I actually studied art history for all of 5 minutes, which is where the whole idea of patronage, aka financially supporting artists, comes from. Kings and queens would commission artists to create paintings to adorn their castle walls. Upper class lords and ladies celebrated their accomplishments by using their wealth to support the arts. And during the Italian Renaissance, my favorite era, the Medicis actually developed a close bond with Michelangelo, who painted the Sistine Chapel, and the Sforza family supported Da Vinci, who helped name Leonardo DiCaprio. That is a true story, by the way. Anyway, I know that you're not here for a history lesson thrown in to your business studies class, but if you're feeling like a rich Renaissance royal who wants to support your very own little Botticelli here, then Patreon is the solution for you. Simply tap the link in the show notes to select your tier of patronage to support the show. It starts from a low amount and it really means a lot to help me to continue producing these interviews that I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for listening. Let's get back into the episode. All right, well, let's kind of keep going on the timeline. So top growing pains when you scaled the business from the small team, I think at the height, was it like 200 staff?
About 200 people.
How far did you get in terms of series? Was it series C, D, and funding?
E? I don't even know. There was so. I think it was series E by the very end, yeah.
What are the most painful growing pains throughout that journey that have stuck with you?
I'm gonna try not to say all the usual ones. I mean, without doubt, is the utter culture catastrophe that comes with growing, like with a headcount doubling.
Was there a specific point?
It was pace. I think it was probably after that series. But I won't bore you with all the detail. But we essentially moved into a new business line of mortgage lending on top of being a mortgage broker, which meant we had to essentially double the size of the company and be much more heavily regulated and much more grown up. Right. It was nothing to do with the specific individuals, but that was extremely tough culturally. And suddenly you've got, and I'd seen it at Wonga before, you've got the kind of calcified old guard problem against the new kind of more narrowly focused professionals who you desperately need to actually get your company to function. And it was really hard.
How did you navigate that?
I think probably not brilliantly in retrospect is the truth. And actually the truth is we then got just hit by the storm of COVID. And so that ended up a bit like these hand grenades that roll into your life, whether personally or professionally, that just changed everything. And suddenly the culture in that way just didn't seem important anymore. Like, we were sort of 200 souls lost at sea, like everybody else, just trying to figure out how to survive both as individuals and as a company. That just brought us together in a completely different way.
Right,
all of that, you know, old guard stuff disappeared.
So do you mean that it sort of forced that became the bigger problem
100%.
And then everyone else just had sort of bigger problems, if you like, at that point?
Yeah, I think for me and I think for all of us, it really changed everything. We were just, I don't, you know, for everyone it was different, but you were alone. Yeah. And then suddenly, actually these people at the end of this awful bloody Zoom thing, like, were the most, they were incredibly important. They were your lifeline. And of course, like, you know, you still want to hit all your numbers and you're worried about the next fundraise, but you're also worried that that guy lives alone and has always seemed like he doesn't, you know, talk to enough people as it is, and how is he coping and what's going to happen? And so it was a lot, of that. And I think, like, by far the most difficult part of my career, but by a million miles. Like, I think it was the moment where I, like, stopped being like an awful psychopath. I was like, oh shit, like, this is real. Like, these are real, like, I've got, like, a pastoral duty to, like, to care for these people, and I'm going to try.
I feel like I just ruined that perfect soundbite by laughing too. I always try and hold back in case.
I think it's fine.
That's hilarious. I'm also currently reading American Psycho, so that's hilarious.
It wasn't that bad.
No, of course not, because what I was just going to say is I recognise that empathy that you demonstrate, you know, using that example of, you know, that one guy. And I'm not sure if this was around the same sort of time, but I believe you now have three kids. You came into fatherhood.
So many kids. It's more blind optimism and bad choices. That could be the name of my biography, in fact.
Your podcast. Don't give me more competition, Dad. But yeah, I'm not sure, you know, the exact sort of timelines, but I just want to kind of connect the dots with that as well. Because I remember hearing you talk about how, you know, fatherhood helped to cultivate an even deeper sense of empathy for you, and how that helped you become more of an empathetic leader, which I massively admire. But without going down the dad route too much, because I know there's so many other things I want to talk about. One particular thing that stood out to me, hearing your fatherhood story combined with, you know, fast paced scale up founder, solo founder, everything else, was how it forced you to carve out intentional time to spend either reading or just to get I think you said, you know, a Friday morning just to kind of carve, because now you didn't have the luxury of easy weekends or quiet evenings. I'm really interested in hearing about, were there any other really kind of practical, straightforward things that you did as the company was growing, as your life was getting tighter and tighter? Is there anything along those lines of, like, a Friday morning dedicated to reading that could help maybe another founder that's going through that scale-up process?
Yeah, I do think it touches upon something we said earlier. I think insecurity is the great bane of the founder, and it's ironic because they're all selling their wares so confidently all day.
Right.
And I think it comes in different forms. Like, sometimes it's the one I was, I think, guilty of is I always felt like I had to be the hardest working person in the company. And if anyone thought that I wasn't working, then they wouldn't work and then it would all fall over. For others, I think it's insecurity about their peer group. And, you know, like, oh, Nick from Revolut's growing faster, which was always a problem for me a little bit. but, you know, so you're gazing outside of the company and thinking, I've got to do more. But the truth is that everybody's, I think you have to be realistic about who you are. And so, you know, for example, for me, as an intro, like, I'm very introvert, like, and by that, not, I think people mistake introversion for meaning, like, not wanting to talk to people. But for me, the definition of introversion versus extroversion is, do you, when you're tired and exhausted and you need energy, what do you do? Do you want to sit on your friend's sofa and have a chat, or do you want to be alone? And for me, it's very much, I want to be on my own. And in a universe, you know, where, I mean, you feel it, and it sounds grandiose, but even if you're walking to the bathroom in the office, like, the 20 new people in the office are watching you going, oh yeah, there's that guy who's on the Zoom, so there he is going to the loo. And if you're an introvert, like, it really is like a lot of mental load to be permanently observed. And I think it's just saying, like, well, what is it, if I need to, like, create new energy for myself, like, find a little bit of serenity amongst this madness, and it is madness, what does it take? And so, yeah, for me it was reading and learning Chopin like a geek. Although this, I used to get mocked because for me it was playing the piano and playing chess, and everyone was like, what are you, like a Russian six-year-old? Like, this is very strange. My wife would viciously mock me for my hobbies. But it really helped, and I've really tried to hold on to it even as I go into a very, like, a much smaller venture.
Lovely. How do you, oh, I'm glad you reminded me on the music front, because I know you have a bit of a double life as a guitar wielding musician, so yeah. I want to touch on that as well
for
very
my
quickly
sins.
But I think, just very quickly, how do you go about, on a really practical level, setting those boundaries? Is it literally a case of just saying, I'm in meetings all of Friday morning, don't disturb me?
You're going to laugh at me. It's so
geeky. No, it's so geeky.
I made a spreadsheet and I, like, worked out all of the hours I was in one-to-ones, all the hours I was in skip levels, all the hours I was in group meetings, all the hours I was in external meetings, and just was like, I'm not, and was like, this is as many as I'm willing to do. So I think I just capped it at 15. I wasn't willing to do more than 15 meetings a week. So I'd do 3 meetings a day, apart from our morning huddle. And so then just wouldn't take meetings in the mornings. And it was great. So every morning, whether it was reading or like knocking out an investor deck or whatever, like whatever I felt like that essential thing that needed to be done. And everyone just got used to it. Everyone
did you ever struggle to even just hold yourself accountable?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like it fell out, like anything, like any diet. Yeah. Like I fell over every 2 months, was like, oh shit.
Yeah, because I definitely have as well. It's coming from, you know, I completely relate to this. I've had to, I'm similar to you. Again, what would come as a big surprise is public speaker, podcast host. I'm also quite introverted. I definitely need to, you know, my alone time to re-energize. And so I've done the same. I've carved out those moments. I'm like, don't disturb. But you're like, I really need an extra half hour sleep here.
Exactly.
And like, but if you've got a call with someone or a meeting, you're like, you'll show up.
It's hard to say no. I think like learning to say no is like an extraordinarily important skill for everybody.
Right.
But
exactly.
Particularly if all the pressure of your enterprise is on you.
Exactly. All right, quick one on the guitar, because I did touch on that, and okay. Then we're going to move on. How has that helped you become a better founder CEO, if at all?
I don't know if it has. It's given more reasons for the people I work with to mock me, mostly. No, I mean, I did it. It was my job for 10 years. I made a lot of music that no one wanted to listen to in various bands and as a session player. And I think this is, again, it's a bit trite, but I think it taught me how to learn. So like just because, you know, because music is like a never-ending practice. And so I think it really like allowed me to go deep on things and like and be realistic about my own level of skill and what I needed to do to get to the next level. So I think it was important in that way. But aside from that, no, I'm not sure.
No,
I tell you the one thing is that I thought, because I've been, you know, been on stage quite a bit, and I really thought that would help with public speaking. But I still, even to this day, like even in internal all hands, like I still feel a bit sick before an all hands. And so I think there are some things that is just, they're a muscle that you build,
yeah,
that you can't really change your intrinsic feelings, right, about like things like public speaking. So I think music over the years, the more I've done it, the more public speaking I've done, the more comfortable I've got on stage, and the more playing music on stage I've done, the more comfortable I've got with public speaking.
Yeah, it's just like exercising that learning muscle,
exactly,
isn't it,
yeah,
essentially? I love that. Okay, so we're going to speed through a little bit.
All
so
right.
I know I want to finish off the Habito chapter and then get on to communion. Something else I really want to give you kudos for is transitioning out away from your baby and bringing in another CEO into Habito. Mm. So what led you to make that decision? That must have been quite tough as well, because obviously it's your baby, but I really do admire founders who have got that level of self-awareness to say this beast just requires,
for sure,
someone else to take it on that next stage of its journey.
You gotta call it when the moment comes. And for me, it was the honest truth is the thing that we were building that got knocked off course by COVID was the thing that I was really excited about. And I think if it weren't for COVID, then that maybe that would have been the right moment. Obviously, that's a circular reference, but I think that would have been the moment for me to think about what I was going to do next, because I'd sort of fallen in love with that corporate. I didn't want to be a mortgage broker. I'd been thinking day in and day out about it for years, and I was kind of done thinking about it. And when sort of because of the impacts of COVID, that was going to be our primary business. Like as I say, for about 2 years there, it became all about the people and less about the business. And I really loved that, and that was really great for me. But once the business was stabilized, like I just didn't care how many mortgages we broke this month. And once you realize that's true, like you've got to get out of there before you destroy the thing you made and undo all of the good work that everybody has done with you. So we found a great guy who I kind of both trusted to, you know, be a good steward of the business, but was also like a good dude who I could really imagine sort of being a caring and thoughtful leader to the group. And he's doing a great job. So I've been really fortunate for that to be like a completely painless transition without any like regret or spite or any other stuff that can. And I think that my one brilliant strategic move was not becoming chairman. I think that's the worst thing you do, is like hanging around and like looking over their shoulder and just reminding everyone of the past when like it needs to be the next day.
Yeah, interesting. Like fresh blood, new chapter.
Just get rid of the old guy. Deadwood. You just gotta get him out of there.
Totally. Amazing. All right, so let's go on to the communion chapter. So you recently started your second venture, which is so exciting. You mentioned, obviously,
Madness.
Uncommon did the branding for that as well. So what is communion? Give us the elevator pitch.
So the short version is, So I've been doing this for a long time, across a few of these businesses, and I guess in different ways, it's always been the same thing. Like, we're always like, we're going to make it faster, more frictionless, cheaper, more optimal, you know, very much the sort of the engineer's approach. And I think that is the nature of fintech in general. And I guess I just had this, like, really, like, this feeling in my stomach that I couldn't get rid of, that for all of the work we'd put in, and, you know, as an individual, as the companies I've been in, as a market, that we hadn't really solve the core problem, which was people feel really, really awful about money in general and carry around a huge amount of anxiety. And so we've done a bunch of survey work. I think 95% of, you know, Gen Z and millennials experience frequent money anxiety. And that money anxiety compounds and can be quite toxic, right? It can be the bill you get in the morning, it turns into the argument you're having with your boss in the afternoon, or, you know, and certainly every argument that you have about money in a relationship is never really about money. It's about agency and control and priorities. And it just, that was sort of the penny drop. I was like, oh, we've been trying to solve the money problem, but money is really a people problem. And so that was the goal of Communion, was to really try and attack that head on. And instead of, instead of sort of saying, listen, we're going to round up your change or invest your money in a basket of ETFs or whatever random thing, instead we're going to try and fundamentally fix your relationship with money and go deep. Like, figure, you know, most people's attitudes to money are formed before the age of 7. And like, we're going to find those, we're going to unpick those biases, those blind spots, that kind of cognitive distortion, and try and allow you to build good habits, and, you know, essentially kind of try and manage that anxiety and all of the sort of unpleasant knock-on effects that it brings to your life.
Whilst Habito's in the prop tech space and this is fintech, it still sounds...
It's a bit of a weird one. I don't know what it is.
But it's when you tell that story, actually it sounds like a very natural transition for you, because you're really solving these deep pain points that a lot of people experience. So whether it's buying your first home, but this is another kind of financial issue that people still kind of, that deeply resonates. Exactly. So what actually is it then? Is it an app? What do you do with it?
So it's an app. You do three things in the app. So it's iOS only for now. We've been live for maybe 5 months now. So it's brand new, which is awesome and very exciting. But essentially what you do is every day, it sounds kind of trivial, but you go in and you save £1. So you literally drag a pound on the screen. And the idea there is that, again, technology makes you passive, right? So we round up the change, or we take the direct debit, or we do it for you. And we really want, and what that robs you of the opportunity to do is to connect it to your identity. If it's happening without your active involvement, then it's not part of who you are. So this sort of ritual, if you like, every morning of pushing this pound has proven very popular and very powerful. And then what happens straight after that is you'll do normally we go into this sort of deconstruction of the psychology and the sort of the cognitive components of finance and anxiety and saving. And that's it. So every morning, save, go through the process of learning. And then underneath that, there's obviously quite a lot of infrastructure, and we offer, you know, best in market rates. And if you bring your friends with you, then you get great, you know, lots of bonuses. But the core thing is we want to shift people from being really at the whim of kind of late capitalism and, you know, like being absolutely annihilated with Instagram ads telling them that they're not attractive enough or not cool enough or whatever it might be, and say, listen, like, we get it, it's tough out there, but what you need to do is galvanize yourself. And it sounds a little really sort of silly, but this tiny act of defiance every morning of pushing this pound seems to really do that for people. So that's the core of what the app is at the moment.
Amazing. It sounds awesome. So I appreciate it's super early days. So a very big question I'm going to hit you with here, but if Communion is as successful as it can be, then what would the world look like in 10 years time?
God, that's a great question. I think even with like great ambition, like there is a certain level of humbleness. Like there is a thousand voices vying for your attention in any moment. But I think if we can offer like a moment of daily relief, if we can, the compounding effects of that over time, like make a few fewer people die poor, like that would be extraordinary. And I think, and it's so interesting when you really stare at these problems. I think 75% of under 40s are on track to not be able to retire comfortably. So it's like a endemic in the population. The savings rate is not high enough, mainly because we're told to buy stuff day in and day out, and it's very hard to resist. But the difference in what you would need to do in order to solve that problem is actually really small. It's not like everybody needs to start saving £1,000 a month. And actually, I think if you save a pound a day, from the age of 22, you would have 50% of what you need for a comfortable retirement at the point of retirement, which is pretty bonkers. So it's kind of a funny thing, like this very small, kind of quite humble act that you would make every day, if we could scale it up to millions of people, yeah, it would make a real change to the, you know, to the sort of the, maybe the net level of happiness in the world.
Yeah, these huge compounding effects. I mean, even just that as well, I really do wish someone had told me sooner, like to start, you know, putting something aside for my pension, so even a pound, you know, a small amount, the earlier the better. So any young people, anyone under the age of 30, 25, if you take anything away from this, then get
come
contributing
see
to your pension.
Exactly.
Okay, very sadly, I'm going to have to wrap up with the final question, even though I've got 50 million more I'd love to ask you. But closing tradition on this podcast is to ask our guests, often the best lessons can come from the biggest mistakes, hence the title of the show, Strategy and Tragedy. We've obviously touched on some low moments so far, but is there one particular tragedy that's taught you an unforgettable lesson?
God, that's such a good question. I don't want to. The truth is, we've sort of covered it. I think it was COVID, which was a sort of universal tragedy, but that totally like upended my worldview. I think, though, if I was to try and choose something else,
what was the lesson from COVID, though?
I think very much that you think that these things, like, I should be careful how I describe it, but you're a young man and you want to win and you want to make your impact on the world. And of course, you could be a young woman, but for me, I was a young man. And you sort of, you know, you have a superiority complex about what can be achieved, and you think everyone's like not clever enough or not trying hard enough or doesn't have like an acute enough perception of the problem. And so you run at an incredible pace and you put yourself and everybody around you under incredible pressure. And I think there is a point, I think there's a degree to which you can dehumanize both yourself and the people you work with and the customer in that process, because like it's so, but that success is so fundamentally important to you. And you really feel like if you don't achieve it, like you'll be nothing and everything will fall apart. And I think COVID for me was just like the first time, probably since I was a musician, that I ran into a wall at full pace. You know, we've raised £1 billion in debt to lend, you know, hundreds of people working on this project. And just overnight, like it just was not viable anymore for a bunch of boring reasons involving interest rate swaps. And that, I think just going through that, and having to, you know, furlough a ton of people, make people redundant, shut down this business line I'd spent 4 years architecting. It was amazing. I didn't die. No, the people I cared about didn't leave me. And actually, like, in I think sort of coming to terms with my own frailty, it made me much more able to come to terms with the frailty of others. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, I think it's a weird... Yeah, I think that if I had to boil it down, I think being an entrepreneur is dehumanizing in a bunch of ways and encourages you to dehumanize others. And I think trying to find a way to connect with yourself and others in the midst of the madness is a worthwhile endeavor.
So it sounds like it was a very humbling and revelatory experience.
Totally.
We are running out of time, but did you want to give another answer on that, on the big
tragedy? I don't know if I've got another good one. I mean, I've got loads.
I'm sure I run out. We'll leave it there for now then. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show. Absolute pleasure. The time has absolutely flown.
Yes.
Really appreciate you coming on. And thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate you tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed this. Stick around for next week's episode and we'll see you there.